Welcome. You're listening to Latin Waves with your hosts, Sylvia and Stuart Richardson. Latin Waves is a syndicated show produced in the studios of CJSF Radio in Burnaby, BC. Latin Waves is more than just hot rhythms. This is a show about community, about creating a culture that is inclusive and based on fairness. Because everyone deserves dignity, respect, and has something to contribute. A new world is possible, and it all starts with us.
Probably the Venezuelan Revolution and the Latin American Revolution were just the precursor of a wider revolutionary movement. If you see, there's been the revolts in the Arab countries where the dictators were overthrown. I mean, the revolution over there is not finished by any stretch of imagination, but at least it has started. The revolutionary process has definitely started. It then jumped over the Mediterranean onto the south of Europe, where we've seen Greece, Portugal, Spain, Italy, and now is moving over to France and other countries where working people are saying enough, and we're not going to pay for the crisis of capitalism.
That's the voice of Jorge Martin, International Secretariat of Hands Off Venezuela. On this show, we talk about the long-lasting legacy of Hugo Chavez and also about potential revolutionary movements of the future. So stay tuned.
The world has been mourning now the death of Hugo Chavez. We have heard worldwide the expressions of love and the sense of loss. To speak about this, my guest is Jorge Martin. He is the Secretary of HEFSAS Venezuela, and we reach him in Spain. Thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
Now, when we think about the loss of Hugo Chavez, it's hard to not be moved to tears. And yet, the legacy of what was made possible and the legacy is what I think we need to also reflect upon. So, who was Hugo Chavez?
Yes, I think there's maybe two or three different aspects. One is that in the last week, or maybe 10 days now, there's been millions of people have come out on the streets in Caracas and throughout the country, and even in tributes being organized all around the world. If you were to listen to what the mass media are saying, you would think that the people have gone mad, because they describe Venezuela as a crime-ridden country with a collapsing economy and so on. So why are people coming out in the millions waiting for 24 hours, 36 hours just to see his coffin? It doesn't make sense, but the truth is very, very different. The truth is that during the president's term of office, which has lasted for 14 years, he has fundamentally transformed the living conditions of millions of Venezuelans, particularly from the poorest sections of society. I mean, poverty has been halved. The levels of extreme poverty have been cut by 70%. There's been a massive transformation because in terms of healthcare, education, even housing. This is an example I like to give. In Spain, in 2 years, they've evicted 350,000 families from their homes because they can't pay the mortgage, and the banks have repossessed the homes. In Venezuela, in 2 years, they have built 350,000 new homes and given them to families in need. But I will say that this is just one aspect. There's the massive social programs, massive improvement on the living conditions of a majority of the population. The other side of this is that in Venezuela there is a revolution, i.e. the political involvement actively of millions of people who were previously disenfranchised from the political process, mainly coming from the poorer sections, working class, also large sections of the middle class. And the people have had to come out and defend this revolution, which has been democratically voted and ratified many times, to defend it against the assaults of the oligarchy and imperialism during the coup in 2002, the bosses' lockout in 2002, counter-revolutionary riots in 2004, so many times. And through this process, and also because of the political education that Chavez carried out, the people have become politically aware, politically organized, and they feel for the first time that their future is in their own hands. This is a very powerful feeling, and one that is very dangerous for the elites that have dominated the country for 200 years. And maybe the third aspect of his legacy is the struggle against imperialism. He's a country that stood up to the to imperialist meddling in Latin America, managed to defeat the attempt to introduce the free trade of the Americas agreement, and brought about a certain degree of integration of Latin America. The revolution is by no means finished or completed. There are many challenges ahead. But I will say that from the point of view of those of us who are struggling for a better world, the legacy is overwhelmingly positive. Oh, I just forgot to add that he also opened the debate in 2005 about socialism, when he said that, that the future of the revolution could not be contained within capitalism, that the aims of the revolution could not be contained within the system, and that the revolution had to go towards socialism, thereby opening a big debate, not only in Venezuela, but beyond, about what socialism means, why is it still relevant, how it should be different from Stalinism in the 20th century, and so on. He played a really, really amazing role, and it was all concentrated in a short space of time.
Not only do we see in him a new way of imagining the world, but also a new path to engaging in a political sphere that strives to create equity and parity, right, among among players. So can you talk a little bit about the journey now? Because when you look at the media, immediately after the death of Hugo Chavez, we have Stephen Harper calling on, you know, with this nonsense that it would be now a democratic country. And so can you speak about how do we defend the Bolivarian revolution? What are the urgent threats that we face?
Well, obviously, not only the Canadian government, but also the U.S. government, which is a much more powerful player, been talking about a transition towards democracy, about meaningful democratic reforms and things like this. This is all very ironical, isn't it? Because Venezuela is a much more democratic country than the United States is, or Canada for that matter. I mean, in Venezuela there have been 15 or 16 different electoral processes in these last 14 years, and they've all ratified this process. And the last one, or the last bad one, on October the 7th last year, when Chavez was re-elected, they had a turnout of 81% of the population turned out to vote, 81% of the electoral register turned out to vote, and 55% voted for Chavez. I mean, I struggle to find another example anywhere in the world where there's so much involvement of people in politics, including people who are against Chavez, who felt that they had a chance to defeat his policies, and they didn't, but nevertheless they turned up to vote. And Chavez said, I think it was in July 2011 when they started with this campaign about the need for a transition, when his cancer was first reported, he said, they should make no mistake, there is only one transition in this country, and this is a transition from capitalism, the system that's destroying the planet, to socialism, which is the system that is the future of humanity, the hope for humanity. And I think that we need to defend the Bolivarian revolution. There are elections coming up now on April the 14th. This is also different from the United States. In the United States, the president dies and the vice president takes over, finishes his term of office. In Venezuela, new elections are called, which I think is more democratic. And we need to defend it because it's a beacon of hope for the rest of the world. As I said, in Europe, there is now a very acute capitalist crisis whereby healthcare, education are being cut, public services are being privatized, people are being evicted from their homes, banks are being bailed out while people are being left out with nothing. Cuts in pensions are being implemented and in all sorts of social benefits that were won over the last 50 or 60 years. And Venezuela has proven that the opposite policies are possible. And I think we can derive a lot of hope and inspiration from Venezuela. And this is a strong reason to defend it against any attempts of U.S., Canadian, or Spanish, or other imperialist powers to intervene. I mean, the people of Venezuela have said what they want, and they will have another chance yet to vote for which project they support. And they should be allowed to do so without any foreign interference.
you know, it's interesting that, well, worldwide, the IMF is calling for austerity and cuts to social spending. In Venezuela, during his reign, social spending increased by 60.6%, and to amazing results, as you have pointed out. The issue of socialism is one that most people are unacquainted with, primarily because there has been such a deliberate attempt to silence any ideas that divert our attention from capitalism as the only possible alternative or as the only possible way to organize our social interactions. Can we talk a little bit about what this socialism of the 21st century would mean for political systems in Canada or in Spain, for instance, if they were to become on par with the processes in Venezuela?
Yes, there are many different interpretations of what socialism of the 21st century is. And since Chavez raised the idea, many people have interpreted it in different ways, including many who want to take the edge off of what he actually said and try to transform socialism of the 21st century into something which is a mixed economy between socialism and capitalism. But what he actually said is, we must go towards socialism. Socialism must learn from the mistakes of the 20th century, so it cannot be bureaucratic as it was, and I think that's correct. And socialism must be democratic and participatory. I think that's a very good description of socialism. For me, socialism is the common ownership of the means of production, i.e. the means of creating wealth, so that they can be democratically planned instead of being anarchically run, in the interest of the majority of the population, instead of being in the hands of an unelected handful of people who run it for their own private profit. For instance, in the United States now, I think the figure is that there are $2 trillion of cash stashed away in the companies, in the big company, big business bank accounts. It's not that they are not investing because interest rates are not low enough or they cannot borrow money. There's no credit. The reason they're not investing is because they cannot make a profit. The reason they cannot make a profit is people don't have money. And people don't have much money because they have high levels of debt, which they acquired in the previous period of economic growth, when credit was fomented as a way of getting people to buy things they can't buy with the wages of tomorrow instead of buying with the wages of today. So it is the crisis of the capitalist system. It's not that there are no resources, there's no idle productive capacity. It's not that there are no people able and willing to work. I mean, in Spain, where I come from, there's 6 million unemployed. Youth unemployment is 60%, and these are mostly highly qualified youth with the university degree and speaking a couple of foreign languages and so on. And the capitalist system is completely unable to use all this productive capacity. And I will say that socialism is a system whereby the profit motive is not the dominant force in the economy, but the common interest. And for this to be possible, we need to nationalize the economy. Expropriate the small minority to control capital and factories and the land, and put those resources under common ownership, i.e. the ownership of everybody, and public democratic control. I think that's a fair description of what socialism should be. And from a political point of view, this will involve the direct participation of everyone in the running of society, not just by voting once every 4 or 5 years for one set of politicians or another who will then mostly carry out the same policies, but to be able to participate directly in the running of your own factory, in the running of your own neighborhood, in the running of the services that you have access to, and basically in the running of all common affairs at different levels in a democratic way.
It's interesting that when we think about a society that's democratically run, a lot of people feel afraid. You know, we don't have the experts to tell us what to do. Ordinary people don't know how to run an economy. Ordinary people don't have the degrees to show us. And so I wonder if you could address that, because while we as workers need to overcome our own internalized oppression, we can also look to the examples that are being set before our eyes by ordinary people through the Bolivarian Revolution in Venezuela.
Yeah, I mean, first of all, experts and technicians will not be abolished under socialism. They could still give us the tools so that we can make an informed decision, obviously. But at the same time, workers themselves, although most of the times they don't realize, they are actually the ones who are running society. Without the kind permission of the working class, not a wheel turns, not a light bulb shines. And in Venezuela, there have been some amazing examples of this. During the lockout in 2002, the bosses' lockout, the workers took over PDVSA, which is the oil company, state-owned oil company, which runs on very technologically advanced processes, computerized and satellite systems and so on. And they basically, without the directors and managers who left the company and sabotaged the processes, they were able to recover production and even increase it. And there's many examples like this. There's, for instance, an occupied factory in the state of Miranda. It's called the National Valve Making Factory. When the workers took it over and then it was later nationalized, they managed to increase production while decreasing the number of hours and the level of exploitation of the workers, and they run it much more efficiently. And how were they able to do this? Because they know directly how the production process works, and they had realized for a long time that there were a number of things that could be improved and so on. But because this didn't fit with the general pattern that was being brought down by management, they were never allowed to make these changes. Now that they were in control, they could make those changes. Even within capitalism, to a certain extent, some forms of schools of management recognize this. For instance, in Japan and in some of the car industries, there are suggestion boxes where the workers can make suggestions about how to improve the process. And in this case, the capitalists appropriate this knowledge for their own benefit. But if it was implemented on the basis of workers' control, we could improve and increase production while decreasing the levels of exploitation, decreasing the working hours, and so on. And this has been demonstrated in practice in Venezuela in so many different small and bigger examples.
I wanted to point out that Hugo Chavez won another battle, and that was the idea that elections can be democratic and they can be legitimized by a wide participation of the population. In the 16 elections that he won those elections by more than 10 to 20 points ahead of their opponents. Can you talk about the kind of political possibilities that open when you create spaces for mass cooperation between the working class, the specialists, you know, which are another class among themselves? But when we bring this two into a socialist system, what are the possibilities that we create?
No, not only this, but Chavez got his largest share of the vote, 60%. In the 2006 presidential elections, which is right after he declared himself a socialist, and he said, these elections are not about me, these elections are about capitalism or socialism. So that also proves that the idea that we are given that you have to be moderate or you have to water down your program in order to win votes is precisely demonstrated to be wrong, and it's the opposite in Venezuela. The more radical Chavez became, the more votes he got. The revolution is by no means finished, and there are many challenges ahead. I mean, the economy is still basically a capitalist economy, and the state is still largely the old state that was created before. But they have established, for instance, communal councils. I'll just give you one example. They have this housing program. It's called Misión Vivienda, the housing mission, and they aim to build 2 million new homes in order to fill the gap of people who need new homes, people who live in overcrowded conditions or live in shacks and so on. And a large proportion of this project is run by the communal councils, i.e. by the communities themselves. I visited one in November when I was there, and the community itself had decided where these new homes were going to be built, what kind of homes. They didn't want blocks of flats, they wanted smaller homes. who were going to be the main beneficiaries. They established a number of criteria because there's obviously a queue. Not everyone can be satisfied at the same time. The state had provided them with the money, but they themselves had hired the technicians, the architects, and so on, which were working under the control of the communal council. Then they got the labor, either building workers, from amongst themselves in the community and neighboring community. People were unemployed and so on. They sourced the materials from local factories as much as they could, and the families themselves and the community as a whole participated in the actual building and the process of decision making and everything. And when I arrived there, it was at the point when they were already about to finish the homes and hand them over to the families. You could feel that this was not just new homes in a community. This was a whole community that had built these homes, and this gave them a sense of pride, of belonging, of which really transformed the life and the relationships in that particular community. Now, if you multiply that by the whole of the communal councils and the social projects that exist in Venezuela, you can feel how a new consciousness is arising, one that is collective, that is not that you do not aim to solve your own individual problems, but you see the solution to this as part of a collective effort that's more efficient. And so it's a really amazing transformation. I will say that some of these examples, which are not known outside of Venezuela, not generally known, are precisely the reason why the mass media are lying so much about Venezuela, because they don't want this example to be replicated elsewhere.
President Chavez died on March 5th, 2013, at the young age of 58 years, and his legacy has been felt. The worldwide expressions of love were, to me, resonant, and then it seemed almost curious that 2 weeks later, a new pope is elected, and for the very first time in centuries, this pope comes from Latin America. How do you read this event?
I'm not an expert in the pope, but I will say that everything that's come out so far about his past track record is that he belongs to the Jesuit order, which in Latin America has played quite a progressive role, particularly in Central America, and many of the priests and church people involved in the theology of liberation, religion for the poor, and so on, were coming from the Jesuit order. But it seems that he was coming from the other end of the Jesuit order, that end that supported the hierarchy of the church, that supported dictatorships, particularly in Argentina, that turned a blind eye or blessed them because they were fighting against communism, in inverted commas. So it doesn't look very promising. Not only this, but it seems to me that it's worth noting that Latin America is one of the regions of the world where there's a more advanced revolutionary movement, in Venezuela, in Bolivia, in Ecuador, in Argentina to a certain extent, in some other countries, and the Pope comes precisely from that region. So whether that's a deliberate effort to reconnect the church with Latin America and try to prevent the spread of these revolutionary movements, try to block them in some way, I don't know, but I think it's just worth noting the fact. I mean, in the past, they appointed the Pope from Poland, and this played a certain role in undermining the Soviet Union and so on. Although it was not the main reason for its downfall. I mean, it had its own internal contradictions, the rise of Stalinist bureaucracy and so on. But it was a deliberate attempt to further its undermining. And I will say that this is possibly also the case in Latin America. But the Catholic Church is so discredited now. I mean, the reason why the previous pope resigned is not clear. But it's probably has to do with the enormous pressure of a church which is in crisis, involved in all sorts of scandals, corruption scandals, sex abuse scandals, and so on. And he couldn't take it anymore. So we'll see what happens.
Given the complexity of our movements and the revolutionary processes that we are all going through, from Mexico down to Tierra de Fuego, what are the possibilities for alliances, for synergies and cooperation that can help us not only keep the revolution alive, but spread those seeds of a socialism that is equitable, that is participatory, and that helps us live as one family in the planet that's finite?
Well, I will say that probably the Venezuelan Revolution and the Latin American Revolution were just the precursor of a wider revolutionary movement. If you see, there's been the revolts in the Arab countries where the dictators were overthrown. I mean, the revolution over there is not finished by any stretch of imagination, but at least it has started. The revolutionary process has definitely started. It then jumped over the Mediterranean onto the south of Europe, where we've seen Greece, Portugal, Spain, Italy, and now it's moving over to France and other countries where working people are saying enough, and we're not going to pay for the crisis of capitalism. So I think that in that sense, when the Venezuelan Revolution started in 1998, they were more or less isolated in the world, but they are now part of a worldwide process which they helped create. And this, I will say, is the source of this unity or feeling of solidarity, in the fact that so many people were feeling sad and paying homage to Hugo Chavez all around the world, from the Philippines to Finland, from Spain to the United States, where there's been a strong showing of solidarity with Venezuela, particularly amongst the 2 million people who benefited from cheap heating oil in the winter, thanks to a program of the Venezuelan government. So this is what really gives us this feeling of being part of a worldwide movement, a worldwide process. In the 1970s, there was a similar movement, similar process, 60s and the 70s, revolution spreading throughout the world. For one reason or another, most of these revolutions were derailed or defeated or smashed. And now we live in an epoch where we will have new opportunities. It is up to us whether we take this to a conclusive victory. And I'm optimistic about the perspectives in that respect.
Thank you so much for being with us this morning.
Thank you.
Take care. Bye. My guest is Jorge Martin. He is Secretariat of Hands Off Venezuela. We reached him in Spain.
Cambia lo superficial, cambia también lo profundo.
We have come to the end of our show, Latin Waves. Latin Waves is a weekly syndicated program produced and broadcast from the studios of CGSF Radio in Burnaby, BC. The program is available free of charge to campus and community stations across Canada and the U.S. For more information about our work or to support our efforts, please visit our website at www.latinwavesmedia.com. Bye for now.